trained husband and wife heart surgeons, who didn't belong in the world of espionage and rebellion, had both died fighting for what they believed. Folland wanted to be sick. He was close enough to see everyone on the driveway climb into the sedans and then race away from the house. The roof of the building was fully engulfed in flames now, and it was clear the entire place would burn to the ground before the fire department came. And it was Drexler and the Syrians who had escaped. Not Rima. Not Tarek. Not Bianca. No one else would be leaving that building with their lives. He assumed Drexler himself must have killed Bianca, somehow doing it right under the noses of the other men. As soon as the last of the three vehicles raced back down the driveway, Voland stepped out of the pear trees and up to the driveway. He told himself he should be running into the burning building, screaming the names of the women, pulling them out on his back. But again, just as his thoughts of shooting the madmen who'd caused this all drifted away, so did his fantasies of coming to the rescue. A portion of the burning roof overhang collapsed down on the parking circle right on top of Voland's car. He turned away from the farmhouse and towards the road, hundreds of meters distant through the trees. He shuffled as he walked, because he had nowhere to go. His mobile phone rang in his pocket, and this startled him. Whoever had been jamming the signal must have shut down their equipment. Quickly, he snatched it up to his ear, hoping against hope it was Rima telling him she'd made it out somehow.
Yes?
But it was the voice of the gray man.
I've got them. We're 10 clicks south of Meza. Clear for now, but I have over 100 clicks to go to the border in less than 4 hours before daylight. Tell me where to...
Voland had stepped off the driveway and begun walking through wet grass towards the winter pear again, because of approaching lights and fire truck sirens on the driveway ahead. As he did this, he interrupted the American.
There has been an event.
What kind of event?
Voland sniffed, cleared his throat.
She's dead. Bianca is dead. They are all dead.
A pause.
Tarek.
Rima.
As I said. They are dead.
Damn it.
How? I tried to help them, Rima and Tarek, but they wouldn't listen.
Was it Drexler?
Bien sûr. It was fucking Drexler along with Malik, a Syrian government assassin, and his team. Guns, night vision, communications jammers. They burned the house down to embers. They slaughtered everyone.
Another pause on the line, but not for long. The American said,
Well, they didn't slaughter everyone, did they, Voland?
Vincent Voland had expected to hear just exactly what he heard next.
I cannot fucking wait to hear the explanation of why you didn't die in that fire with the rest of them.
I swear to you, I tried. I fought with them to understand we were outnumbered. I told them it was futile to-
Stop right there. You ran out on them, didn't you?
Did you hear what I said? Azam's men were here. GIS, Mukhabarat paramilitaries. We didn't know GIS would be involved.
Slowly, the gray man said,
Did you or did you not surrender to Drexler and the Syrians?
I did!
Voland shouted defiantly, his voice echoing off the trees around him. A fire truck raced past on his left.
It was exactly the right move. The move Rima and Tarek should have taken for themselves.
For the next 20 seconds, all Voland could hear was breathing over the phone. Then the American said,
You and I will talk about this again when I get to Jordan.
To this, Vincent Voland made no reply. Fire trucks continued rolling past, and he walked deeper into the cover of the trees.
Hello? The pickup at the border, remember? I need you to focus and give me my coordinates for.
Monsieur, I realize how this will sound, and I'm truly sorry. If it were just me, I would get you and the child out of there. But with the mother gone, it's not me making the decisions. You understand?
Court's voice lowered an octave.
Be very careful about what you say next.
What can I say? The child was a bargaining chip, nothing more. The extraction of the baby was only to earn the compliance of Bianca Medina. But Medina is dead, so there is no way to exploit everything she knew about Azam.
He's leverage.
How? He's an infant. Azam will disavow that baby the moment he knows Bianca is dead. He won't bring a bastard child into his palace without a mother, and Shakira surely won't accept him. Maybe Azam will find another mistress, make another heir, but Jamal Medina is worthless to him now. That means he is worthless to those trying to stop Azam.
The next response from the American was delivered in a matter-of-fact tone that made it all the more frightening to the Frenchman.
I'm going to kill you, Vincent. You know that, right?
Listen to me carefully. If you give me time, I will find a way to get you out. I owe you that for your heroism over the past week. But the Syrian resistance group based in Jordan won't help now, so it won't happen tonight. And even when I do find an exfiltration route for you, it will just be for you. The girl and the baby, that operation is played out. They can't come.
We had a deal, you son of a bitch. I was to bring the child to...
What deal did you have with me? If you will remember, I was firmly against you traveling to Syria. I wanted you up here, where you could protect the Halabis from Drexler.
You promised me you had that end of the operation covered. I was wrong to believe in you.
It was silent for several seconds, until Volden said,
I will find a way to get you out.
Yasmin and the baby too. If I come out, they come out.
Then you have put yourself in a hopeless condition, haven't you?
The American did not reply. Court sat on a pile of rubble in the half-destroyed underground parking garage of a completely destroyed office building. He held the phone to his left ear, and with his other hand he picked out what he hoped was the last shard of protective windshield glass from where several pieces had been lodged under a flap of skin right above his ear. The wound bled freely still, but it was superficial and hardly his biggest concern of the moment. The NDF vehicle he had stolen sat parked 20 feet away in the deepest shadows of the large empty space. He looked over at Yasmin and Jamal, whom he could just barely see through a shaft of moonlight that came through a crack in the concrete roof. She held the baby in her arms and sat with her back against the wall of the garage, looking up at Court. She didn't speak a word of English, this was obvious, because she showed no reaction to the fact that her fate was being discussed in front of her, and things weren't looking good for her right now. But she could clearly see there was a problem. She watched Court intently, certainly wondering why he was yelling at the people that he'd promised were waiting right over the Jordanian border with open arms. Court turned away from the young girl and blew out a long sigh.
What would it take for you to agree to extract the child and the girl?
The Frenchman on the other end of the line said,
What do you mean, what would it take? This is not a negotiation. I have to find people in Jordan or Syria or Lebanon or Turkey who will risk their lives to get you out. I can find someone, probably, but only to get out an able-bodied man of incredible skill. No one would be foolish enough to take on the added danger of an untrained civilian and an infant. There is nothing that would...
Court said,
What if I helped you eliminate Ahmed Azam? Would that do it?
Eliminate?
Assassinate. I won't do it myself, that's impossible. But it might be possible for me to acquire intel that helps the FSA or the SDF or someone out there to kill him. Intel better than anything you could have gotten from Bianca Medina.
Volland sniffed out a surprised laugh.
Ha! Well, yes, of course. In that case, I could find someone who would help me bring out an entire nursery school.
The Frenchman clearly thought Court was joking. But Court just sat there with the phone to his ear. Volland slowly realized the American was serious.
What are you talking about?
Court said,
I know where Azam is going, exactly where he is going. And I can get there myself, close anyway.
How do you know this?
Bianca told me he was going to make an appearance at a Russian military base outside Damascus.
There are a half dozen that I know of, and I assume there are others I don't know about. You can't...
Court cut him off. And then, tonight,
A regime-backing militia officer told me the SAA was creating an unprecedented security cordon around a new Russian special forces base outside Palmyra, possibly for a high-profile visitor.
That's it?
No, that's not it. Yasmin tells me Ahmed told her he'll return to Damascus on Tuesday. I think he'll be at a Russian base in or near Palmyra on Tuesday morning.
That's not enough intelligence to get the FSA to attack a Russian base.
Of course it's not, he said. But here's my offer. You talk to your people in the French government. You know, the ones you aren't working with right now.
Go on.
Find a way to get the kid and the girl out of here, and I'll stay in Syria. I'll go north. I'll try to get more intel on Azam's exact location and the time of his visit. I'll push any intel I get to you, and you push it to the FSA. If they have any assets in the area at all, I'll give them a target.
How on earth can you possibly get close enough to provide intelligence?
That's my problem, not yours. Do we have a deal? Voland took a long time before replying.
What is wrong with you?
Meaning?
Those are not your people. This is not your war. What is your personal motivation? Why are you doing this?
We had a shitty plan from the start. That plan got a lot of people killed, and so far, it's achieved nothing. But I am not going to let Jamal and Yasmin swing in the wind because of our mistakes and miscalculations. I won't abandon them.
But it wasn't your plan.
No, it was yours. You should feel the responsibility for these two that I feel, but apparently you don't.
I am a realist. You are a piece of shit.
Court's rage threatened to overtake him. At this moment, he wanted to kill Voland almost as much as he wanted to kill Azam. But he got control of his emotions enough to reply, This is my offer. I will serve as your agent in place here in Syria, but if I do this for you, then it will leave you with two choices, only two. You get the boy and the nanny out of here through your contacts, or you can do the other thing.
What is the other thing?
The other thing is run and hide, because if you don't come through on this, and I do survive Syria, I'll come hunting you. And since you now see what I will do without any personal motivation, just imagine what I'm capable of when I'm on a mission of revenge. Voland sounded utterly terrified now.
No threats are necessary, I assure you. I agree to your request, I swear, I will not let you down.
Your promises are less than worthless. Show me action.
Of course. Rima gave you the name of someone there in the city you could call on in an emergency.
She did.
Take Yasmin and the boy to him. I know how to reach him, so when all is arranged, I will contact him about the extraction.
Court looked at his watch. Okay. And then? You're all I've got, Voland, and I don't trust you, but I do believe that I scare the living shit out of you. So, I think you'll do your best to come through.
You have my personal motivation figured out, and you're all I have down there with the ability to change the outcome of this horrible war. With you working as my man in Syria, there is some hope for that wretched place.
Court hung up the phone. He didn't find himself filled with the same level of optimism as Voland, and he chalked that up to the fact that Voland wasn't relying on a man who'd double-crossed him and then turned his back on his clients. He looked to Yasmin and switched to French. Back in the car. We're going back to Damascus. Yasmin did not hide the confusion and displeasure from her face.
Yeah, tell me about it,
Court said as he pulled himself off the rubble. Chapter 51. While Vincent Voland continued marching purposefully along the driveway towards the road, 2 full kilometers west of him, a woman stumbled through a large field, waist high with barley. She caught her tennis shoe on a plow track and tumbled to the ground, then struggled slowly back to her feet. She was exhausted. Her hands, arms, and face were covered in cuts and bruises, and she was soaking wet, both from the rain and from the creek she'd fallen into in the woods behind her. Bianca Medina whipped her long black hair out of her eyes with a shake of her head as she pushed on. 35 minutes earlier,
Rima had unlocked the door to Bianca's room and told her that she and Tarek wanted her to run. Ahmed's men had arrived with a man working for Shakira, Rima had explained. And while this meant they didn't know what would happen to her if she was caught, as far as the Halabis were concerned, she needed to get out of the house and into the woods. Rima told her to hide there till either she or her husband came for her later, and to reveal herself only if she heard Rima's or Tarek's voice. The Frenchman, Monsieur Voland, was no longer to be trusted, Rima had hurriedly told her, without providing any explanation. Rima remained in the wine cellar as Bianca ran with Firas up to the kitchen, and then he too stayed behind, holding his gun on the door to the hearth room. As Bianca raced upstairs, following Rima's instructions, she saw several FSEU guards at the top of the stairs, all checking their weapons and making a hasty blockade there from pieces of furniture. But she ran past them, heading over to a bedroom on the northern side of the house. She opened a window and climbed out, then hung down in the darkness, covered from the back by the long side of the farmhouse and partially covered to the front by the long greenhouse that blocked anyone in the drive from seeing her. She dropped down into the wet grass and entered the long, narrow greenhouse so she wouldn't be seen by anyone at the front of the property. On the far side of the greenhouse, she stayed low, ran along the lawn there with long, fast strides, then entered the woods on the northern side of the property, running as fast as her long, athletic legs would take her. She estimated she made it 300 meters or so when she found a place to both hide and get out of the rain in the form of the wide trunk of a toppled oak. She sat there for 10 minutes. For much of the time, she listened to the pops of gunfire, and then all was still. Around the time she'd expected to hear Rima's voice calling to her, she saw a faint glow through the trees in the distance. Minutes after that came the sirens of fire trucks and police cars. Even before Bianca left the wine cellar, she'd seen Rima pulling plastic bottles of turpentine out of the storage room. She hadn't known what she was up to at the time, but as the roof of the farmhouse caught fire and the glow through the trees increased, casting terrifying shadows all around her, she realized what had happened. Rima had been trying to cover Bianca's tracks to make it look like she'd been killed in the fire. Bianca also realized, although she did not know how she knew, that Rima and Tarek were now dead. She waited another 10 minutes, and then she decided she needed to run again. No one was coming to help her. She could feel it. So she moved out through the dark woods, fell into the creek, and cut herself so many times she'd stopped reacting to each new individual pain. She broke out into the barley field and then saw a road in the distance, and she pushed on. Bianca had a plan as to what she would do now. She would get to the road, find a phone, call her friends with the fashion designer that invited her to France, and they would come and pick her up. Of course, she knew she would need a story for where she had been since the ISIS attack 3 nights earlier, but for now, all she wanted to do was get away from there. As soon as she came to the road, a car's headlights appeared from the southwest, and she waved at it frantically, standing by the side of the little road and shivering. The white car slowed and pulled over. Utterly exhausted, Bianca all but collapsed on the passenger side door as she leaned into the window. In the front passenger seat was a Caucasian man in his 40s, a cigarette in his hand. After a moment, he rolled down his window. In French, she said,
"Thank God, monsieur. Please, I need help."
The man just gaped at her, a dumbfounded look on his face. He said nothing, made no movement, just sat there holding his cigarette and staring. But the driver's side door opened, and a young dark-haired man launched out of it. He ran around to her, helped her into the back seat, and then knelt down in the open door, looking her over. It was then she realized the man held a walkie-talkie in his hand. He brought it to his mouth, and he spoke in Arabic.
"This is number 12. I'm on the D-91, west of the property. I have the subject. I repeat, I have the subject. She appears to be unharmed."
Bianca blinked hard, then harder still. Over the radio, a voice in Arabic said,
"What? You're sure?" "Yes, sir. She came running out of the field right in front of my car. Allah be praised. I'm taking her to the warehouse now."
The man lowered the walkie-talkie and smiled at her.
"Madame, I am with the Syrian embassy. We have rescued you, sister. We will get you out of here and, inshallah, back to Damascus where you will be safe from all harm. I promise I will protect you with my life.
Bianca collapsed to her side in the back seat of the car and began sobbing uncontrollably. The Syrian commando ordered Henri Sauvage to drive, and he remained in back with the woman, ready to cover her with his own body if there was any danger. The young man was almost euphoric, and Bianca, it appeared to Sauvage by looking in the rear view, seemed utterly despondent. But Sauvage was thinking about himself, and he realized he had just helped the Syrians grab a missing Spanish national out here in the French countryside, and he, a captain in the judicial police, was the guy driving the getaway vehicle. He'd go to prison for life for this, which meant he'd want a bonus from Eric, for damn sure. And he'd want to get the fuck away from France, probably for the rest of his life, as soon as this was over. The Syrians had what they'd come for now. So he saw the light at the end of the tunnel for the first time in days, and he told himself he just might survive this after all.
Chapter 52. 34-year-old Dr. Shah Kat Siddiqui parked his Nissan Sentra in the reserved space in front of his apartment building and turned off the engine. He sat there a moment, with his eyes closed. It was 3 a.m. He'd worked a 12-hour shift in the ER of Al-Faya Hospital that had turned into a 15-hour shift when the 9 wounded occupants of a bus bombing were brought in shortly before he was due to get off work at midnight. He performed surgery on 3 of them himself and saved 2 lives. But he wasn't happy. He wasn't proud of his work. No. Now, at 3 a.m., he was just fucking spent. He climbed out of his vehicle and walked along the sidewalk towards the back entrance of his building. He was surprised to hear footsteps behind him at this time of night, but not worried. This was an upper-middle-class neighborhood in Al-Medan, in the center of Damascus. This part of the city had been spared much of the war, at least the physical scars of it anyway. The emotional scars? No one in this city was immune from those, just as almost no one in this city was blameless from responsibility for the carnage. Siddiqui arrived at the door and reached forward with his key, but a voice behind him called out softly.
Shawket Siddiqui?
The doctor turned around. In front of him, on the pathway, stood a man with a beard, wearing a wrinkled dark suit. Standing behind him was a small young girl wearing a chador and a long-sleeve cotton shirt with black warm-up pants and a blue backpack. He didn't notice at first, but quickly he realized she held an infant in her arms. Siddiqui might have been nervous to be accosted in a dark parking lot at this time of the morning, but there was nothing threatening about the group in front of him at all.
Assalamu alaikum.
Peace be unto you, Siddiqui said, touching his hand to his heart. It was a polite greeting, but he fought a little disappointment inwardly. He was not accustomed to people showing up at his apartment in the middle of the night. It usually meant he wouldn't be feeling the coolness of his pillow anytime soon, and he desperately needed rest.
Wa alaikum salam,
and peace be upon you, replied both the man and the woman simultaneously. Siddiqui looked them over for any obvious injuries. He saw some blood on the collar of the man's shirt.
How can I?
The man said. Do you speak English? Siddiqui's guard went up, but he wasn't sure why. In Arabic, he replied.
Who are you?
The man continued, still in English.
Doctor, I've been sent by Rima Halabi. It is a dire emergency.
Siddiqui turned away. He put the key in the door lock and opened it. In heavily accented English, he replied.
Please come inside.
10 minutes later, Yasmin sat on a vinyl sofa in a small but tidy apartment on the 5th floor of the building. Jamal was in her lap, and he ate greedily from the bottle she fed him. Court and Shawkat Siddiqui sat at a small bar area in the apartment's kitchen, just a few feet away from Yasmin. The doctor had already made tea for his guests, and he'd put out a plate of cookies and sweets that Yasmin politely declined. Court, on the other hand, dug shamelessly into a stack of cookies made of dates and flour, because he hadn't eaten all day. Siddiqui took out a first aid kit he kept in a back room and began cleaning the wound on Court's head. As he did this, he asked,
So how is Rima?
Court put down his cookie.
I'm very sorry to have to tell you this, but she's dead.
Siddiqui looked up from the bloody wound.
When?
Rima gave me your name 2 hours ago. 1 hour ago,
she was killed.
My God, what about Tarek?
Tarek is dead as well. Siddiqui sighed and poured more antiseptic on a fresh cotton swab, and he went back to work. Court thought the man showed little emotion, and he tried to gauge Siddiqui's relationship with the Halabis from his lack of reaction to hearing about their deaths, but he stopped himself. This guy was a trauma doc in Damascus. He must have seen death every hour of every day of his working life, so his internal meter of heartbreak and sadness must have been so off-kilter, Court knew he couldn't judge the man by how he acted. Siddiqui closed the torn flap of skin, holding it until the bleeding stopped.
The Halabi's two children died last year. I assume you are aware.
Yes. How did you know them?
I was a couple years older than the kids, but their parents and my parents had been friends when we were children. We lost touch after they immigrated when the war began. I had been helping the rebellion here in secret, treating wounded insurgents who showed up at my door. Someone who got out of the country told the Halabis that even though Dr. Siddiqui was working at a regime hospital in the capital, he could be trusted. Tarek reached out to me via encrypted chat, and we've shared information to help save lives. Siddiqui added, "This is back when they were just involved with non-violent aid."
Court said, "And then somehow they became leaders of the insurgency." Siddiqui used glue to seal the skin closed above Court's ear.
"Leaders, no. After their kids died, the only way they could sleep at night was to dream about killing Ahmed Azam and his supporters. Two people in their 50s who'd spent 30 years saving lives learned to dream of taking lives. But now they are dead. All for nothing."
"No," Court countered. "For something. But only if you can help us. The Halabis sent you to me.
Why?"
"This girl and the baby. They need a place to stay. It might be a few days." Siddiqui seemed surprised by the request. He'd obviously expected much more.
"Of course. They are welcome in my home."
"There is something else. It might be that Yasmin doesn't really want to be here." Siddiqui stood up and looked over Court to the girl feeding the baby on the sofa behind him.
"She seems okay."
"What she's been through tonight has been a shock. People react in different ways, trust me, I've seen it. She might be totally compliant now, and then wake up in the morning and try to throw herself out the window to get away." Siddiqui had cleaned the blood from Court's neck, and now he took off his gloves and threw them into the trash. As he did this, he looked again at Court.
"You are asking me to hold a mother and her baby prisoner?"
Court did not want to tell Dr. Siddiqui everything, but he realized he had no choice. "Sit down, doctor." Siddiqui did so.
"In my profession, we tell people to sit down when we are about to give them very bad news."
"It's the same in my profession. That baby, his name is Jamal."
"So?"
"Lots of people name their boys Jamal around here, right?"
"Of course. It is the given name of the man who ran the country for 30 years before his son took over."
"Right," Court said. "But that boy, his father named him Jamal because his father's name was Jamal."
"Who is the boy's father?"
Court shrugged. "Ahmed Azam." Siddiqui shook his head emphatically.
"Ridiculous. Ahmed Azam's son is dead. It is a secret, but Shakira took him to my hospital many times, and we all know."
Court shook his head now. "This isn't Shakira's boy, and Yasmin isn't the mother, either." It took a moment for the doctor to understand, but when he did, he covered his face with his hands and muttered something in Arabic that sounded like a prayer. Finally, he switched back to English.
"Who is the mother?"
"A Spanish woman who has a house here. She's currently out of the country."
"And you brought Ahmed Azam's child here to my flat? I assume people are looking for him."
"I'd say that's a very safe assumption. I can promise you that no one tailed me to your place. The main danger is the girl. She is complying because she's worried she'll be blamed for this, even if she somehow manages to get away. But who knows, like I said, tomorrow she might have second thoughts."
"Again, sir, do you think I just happened to be running a jail in the back of my flat?"
"I didn't have any other place to take her. I have to leave town. Just for a few days." Court looked off into the distance. "I think. I hope." He looked up at the doctor. "If I don't come back by Friday, then I'm dead. and you're on your own. You aren't making a good case for me helping. I hear you've been helping for 7 years. You'll help now, because that kid back there just might lead to the end of this war. How will the child end the war? Better if you don't ask any questions. Siddiqui rubbed his tired face again. After a long time, he nodded, as if to himself, and said, I have a neighbor. He is involved in the local resistance. He is not a leader, but he is a good man. And I suppose he can watch over a girl and a baby for a couple of days in my apartment. If he can't manage that, then I guess that means the resistance is useless. That's good. How soon can he be here? I patched him up after he was shot 2 years ago. Since then, he's brought me other wounded fighters. If I need him at any time, he will be here. I'll call now. Court told Dr. Siddiqui about his contact in France, who was looking for a way to bring the girl and the baby out of the country. He gave Siddiqui Vincent Volin's phone number. Siddiqui asked, This Frenchman, is he reliable? If he screws you or me over, then I will tear off his nuts and shove them down his throat. He knows this. I think he has all the motivation he needs to come through for us. The doctor looked at Court a long time. Court broke the staring contest by glancing at his watch and standing up quickly. I have to get to Babala.
What's in Babala?
The Desert Hawks militia base. I'm sort of working for them at the moment. Siddiqui seemed as stunned at this as Court had expected. Long story, Court explained. It was my cover, and I wasn't planning on using it again, but I'm going to need to find a way to get back in there like none of this happened.
You shouldn't be out on the streets, but I can go anywhere. I'll drive you where you need to go as soon as my neighbor comes to watch the girl.
Chapter 53. At the warehouse just off the grounds of Tassous Lenobla General Aviation Airport, the Syrian commandos tended to their wounded, bagged their dead, and cleaned and reloaded their weapons. Bianca barely spoke a word as she was shown to her quarters, an area in the corner of the warehouse floor partitioned off with sheets hanging from ropes. Inside was a cot, a change of clothes, and a new pair of tennis shoes in her size. For the third time in the past week, people had given her clothes to change into, although it occurred to her that only the Lebanese fashion designer she'd come to Paris to model for had given her anything she much felt like wearing. As soon as she arrived, Malik told her that President Azam wanted to speak with her via sat phone, but she surprised everyone by saying she was just too tired and emotional to talk. She asked Malik to relay the message that, thanks be to God, she had been rescued and was unhurt, and she would speak with him in the morning. It was obvious to Bianca that Malik did not want to disappoint Azam, but also clear he did not want to offend the woman who obviously held a special relationship with the president. So, he reluctantly let it go and offered her canned food, which she declined, and bottled water that she took with her to her makeshift quarters. Rima had warned her that someone with this group had been working with Shakira and had been involved in the ISIS assassination attempt. But even though Rima didn't specify the attractive, blonde-haired Westerner standing on the far side of the warehouse floor, Bianca Medina had decided all the Syrians were working for Malik, and Malik was definitely in the Syrian intelligence services. That left two possibilities as to the identity of the man working for Shakira Azam. There was the gruff man who'd said not a word to her during the drive from the field to the warehouse, and the blonde man. She thought he might be Swiss because of his accent and word choices. He had shaken her hand and told her he had been sent here to Paris by Ahmed himself to help with her recovery. He seemed genuine and sincere, but she had met many men who could charm and deceive simultaneously. She didn't dare say anything to anyone about what Rima had told her. Any hint that the Halabis had allowed her to escape or had communicated information to her would tip off Ahmed's people that she had been complicit in her own disappearance, if not at first, then at least after the fact. She just lay down on her little cot and stared up at the rafters 10 meters above her. She thought about the American down in Damascus, about Jamal, and about the things Rima had told her and shown her about the crimes of Ahmed Azam, and she wondered what the hell she was supposed to do now. Sebastian Drexler gazed across 20 meters of dusty warehouse floor to the beautiful young woman lying on the cot, just barely visible through an opening in the bedsheets hanging around her. He looked her long, slender physique up and down, then fantasized about pulling his pistol from his coat right now, firing a round into that exquisite body of hers, and then spinning around and dispatching Malik's men with perfectly placed bullets to their heads. He could then burn this building to the ground and catch the next train to Bern or Zurich or Gstaad or Lauterbrunnen. It was fantasy, of course. There were still 11 GIS operators here, 9 of whom were fit enough to fight effectively. No, Drexler would have to wait. But he didn't think he'd have to wait too long. An opportunity would arise to kill Bianca as they traveled to the east. He just had to be ready to take advantage of it. As he thought about the hours and days ahead, he looked down at his phone and saw that he had 4 missed calls and a text on his encrypted Commo app. He opened the text. "Answer your fucking phone." It was the First Lady. He sighed, long and hard, because he'd have to call and give her the news that Bianca was still alive and, for now at least, she was surrounded by men who would give their lives to protect her. He walked over to a darkened, distant corner of the warehouse and dialed the number to her satellite phone. Shakira answered on the first ring.
"Damn it, Sebastian!"
"Missed you too," he thought.
"The woman has been recovered."
"Dead or alive?"
"At present, she is alive. I have a plan to..."
"There was a shootout in Meza tonight, in Western Villas. A man escaped. It's on the news. And I'm having my staff bring me updates from GIS.
Drexler was utterly confused and had no idea how this related to him.
"Wait, what man? What are you talking about?"
"They are saying this man kidnapped a baby after fighting security forces. He killed several Bath security officers and more NDF forces that chased him until he disappeared."
"Who was the baby?"
Drexler asked, but he knew the answer.
"On television, they aren't saying anything about the identity of the victims, but they wouldn't, would they?"
Drexler's eyes closed and squinted shut, and he gripped the phone just as hard. He understood now. Understood even better than Shakira what was going on.
"A highly skilled killer who can slip into Syria and kidnap the child of the president. There is only one person who fits that description on this earth."
"Who is he?"
"They call him the Gray Man. He is American."
"What's he doing in Syria?"
"Apparently he is working for the Halabis."
Shakira gasped.
"The man who rescued Bianca in Paris?"
"One and the same. And then he went to Damascus to rescue her son."
Shakira said,
"Once Bianca is dead, this won't matter. He can put the kid on CNN for all I care. Ahmed won't admit to being his father."
Drexler did not reply.
"When will you do it? When will you kill her?"
"I am told we will fly to Serbia in the morning. There we will wait for documents to be sent to us so we can continue on to Russia. From there we'll come home. I'll take care of everything before we leave for Russia."
"You had better," Shakira said.
Drexler passed on a few more promises to the First Lady that it would all be over soon and they would be together again. Then he hung up the phone and looked up to see Henri Sauvage standing over him. Drexler wasn't in the mood.
"What? Why am I still here? I have done every last thing you asked."
Drexler knew Malik was the only one who could release Sauvage at this point, and Drexler figured the only reason Malik had not released Sauvage already was that Malik was going to shoot the French cop in the head at some point and dump his body in a muddy field, simply to tie off one of the many compromises of the past week. Drexler said none of this. Instead, an idea came to him.
"Henri, you might not know it, but you are crucial to this operation. You are in a position of power right now." "What the hell are you talking about?" "The next phase, you might have gathered, involves getting Medina back to Syria. To do that, we have to travel across Europe. I do not have credentials that can pass scrutiny, and neither does Malik. Unlike me, he is here in Europe legally, but as soon as Rima and Tarek are found dead in that house, men with Syrian diplomatic credentials traveling across Europe are going to be looked at with the highest suspicion." "What does this have to do with me?" "You are a French citizen and law enforcement officer. If you came with us,
you could facilitate any dealings we had at airports, with chance encounters with police or others. You could go out and purchase supplies, rent cars, things of that nature. Logistically, you would be a tremendous help. And in the process, I would incriminate myself even more into this crime. My dear Captain, at this stage of the game, I imagine you are already in as deep as you could possibly be. Why not make, say, another 100,000 euros in the process? That money could help you as you transition your life to someplace safer for you. Sauvage just stared Drexler down. Finally, he said, 250,000 euros. Drexler didn't imagine Henri Sauvage would see 50 cents of this money they were discussing, so this was purely a hypothetical conversation. But to the Frenchman, he said, 200. This will be 2 days of work, 3 at most. Then, you can have the rest of your life. Sauvage did not look happy, but Drexler doubted this man ever looked happy. He nodded slowly. Fine. But 3 days at the most, and then I return. Agreed. Drexler didn't really need the Frenchman along on the journey. He could tend to any logistical arrangements himself, using his powers of persuasion and charm. But he saw how Sauvage could prove useful. A plane would land at the airport in a few hours, and it would only accommodate 4 people apart from the pilot. That was Drexler himself, Malik, Medina, and one other person. The Swiss operative would find himself in the air with fewer threats around him and more opportunity to deal with Bianca Medina. If Drexler managed to kill the passengers and crash the plane, and if Sauvage's charred remains were found in the wreckage of a smoldering aircraft crashed on a mountain or somewhere along the way between here and there, and if in said remains Drexler's watch, glasses, and other personal effects were found, then Shakira would think Drexler died along with Medina. This would satisfy Stefan Meyer at the bank, and it would satisfy Shakira Azam, and it would more than satisfy Drexler himself. Just as Drexler had used the dead body of the Finnish photographer to get into Europe, he would use the dead body of the French police detective to finally free himself of Shakira Azam. Now, the only real concern he had was to figure out where the hell he could find a parachute between now and when he boarded the plane in the morning. Chapter 54. Court had Siddiqui drop him off 300 yards from the hole in the gate of the Desert Hawk's base, and he went the rest of the way on foot. He made it through the hole after 5 minutes of prising open the metal links, then belly crawled through the dirt behind the shack next to the motor pool. He brushed himself off, and then, when he felt sure the coast was clear, he ran across the street. He then made his way in the shadows through row after row of metal buildings until he arrived back at the KWA barracks. Infiltrating the facility turned out to be as easy as exfiltrating, if not more so, because there was so little going on in the area at 4 a.m. He saw that the lights were off in the team room, and he slipped inside, heading to the back for the barracks. The lights were off in here, too. A dozen men lay in their bunks, and some snored. As Court moved to his own bunk, he was surprised to see that both Saunders and Braz had already made it back to base after getting picked up by the cops and National Defense Forces militia. He did not see Brunetti or Anders anywhere in the room, but he wondered if Brunetti's broken nose might have had something to do with their absence. He sat down on his bunk and pulled off his shirt, shoving it in his backpack. Just as he leaned over to untie his boots, he heard a banging on the back door of the barracks. KWA men all around him leapt up out of their bunks, grabbing rifles and pistols as they did so. Saunders was first to the door, and he looked out, then unlocked and opened it. 4 Desert Hawks officers moved into the room aggressively, and behind them, several armed militiamen. The mercenaries in their underwear leveled their guns at the new arrivals in the confusion, and shouts were exchanged. Court saw from the action of his teammates that, whatever the hell was going on, this was definitely not a nightly occurrence. The overhead lights came on, and Court was in the center of the action, standing there, shirtless. His lean upper torso had several scrapes and bruises he'd picked up in the past few hours. Van Wyk, the South African KWA team leader, addressed the Desert Hawks colonel angrily. "What the hell is all this about?" The Syrian officer spoke reasonably good English.
There has been an attack in the Western Villas neighborhood in Meza District tonight. A boy and his caretaker were kidnapped, and several security forces were murdered. We have been ordered to do a bed check to make sure all KWA contractors are present.
Van Wyck looked around the room.
We've got a guy in the hospital and another there with him. Everyone else is present and accounted for, so we're obviously not out kidnapping children.
He stuck a finger in the colonel's face, treating the militia officer with no deference at all for his rank.
I want to know why you are looking at us for a crime across town.
The colonel replied coolly.
There was a fight tonight at a bar in Old Town Damascus between Western security contractors, Russian Air Force personnel, and SAA Tiger Forces soldiers. 4 KWA men were arrested but not charged. This tells us at least 4 of you were off base, within a few kilometers of the attack. In addition to this, the security forces in Meza told the police that the kidnapper had top-flight abilities. It wasn't an insurgent group that pulled this off. It was one man. He killed or wounded multiple highly trained men in commission of his crime.
Court saw Saunders flash a quick look his way. Court did not meet his gaze. Van Wyck said,
Look, a few of the boys went out for drinks, no harm, but some tigers were looking to start a row. They got picked up by the police, but the cops let them go.
As he'd feared, one of the young militiamen pointed at Court.
Sir, the others are in their underwear, but this one has his boots and trousers on.
All eyes in the room turned Court's way. The colonel asked,
Where did you get those marks on your body? That cut on your head?
Court said, I was in action yesterday afternoon on the road from Latakia. You must have heard about that.
The colonel nodded.
I did hear about that, but those look fresher.
He walked over to Court, looking him up and down.
Yeah, I was in the bar fight tonight, too.
The colonel seemed to accept this explanation, and Court thought that the danger was behind him, but the Croatian contractor Braz spoke up.
Wait a minute. You are the one guy who didn't get arrested. And when we got back here an hour ago, you weren't in your bunk. Where you been for the past 4 hours, Wade?
What an asshole, Court thought.
There was no other team he could have run with in any other part of the world where one teammate would sell out another so quickly. These mercenaries were hard men who didn't give a shit about camaraderie. Court looked around him. He couldn't fight all these guys, and he didn't see a way to talk himself out of this. But just then, Saunders said,
He's not your man, gents.
Now the attention in the room turned to the British mercenary standing there in his underwear. Saunders said,
Tell him, Wade.
Court said nothing.
It's all right, go on now. Tell him where you were.
Court thought Saunders was trying to help, but it wasn't working. Saunders took over.
After the NDF brought me and Braz back to base, Braz came back here and I went to the loo. Not the one off the team room, but the one off the loadout room. The next building over. Wanted some peace and quiet to take a shit without all the other smelly houses. I walked into the loo, took one look, and turned back around. That bastard right there was puking his guts out in the sink, but it was all over the floor as well. Tell me you cleaned that shit up, Wade.
Yeah, I did. Not a hint anything ever happened, Court replied.
The Desert Hawks colonel turned to Court. To make sure he understood the English slang, he said,
You were sick. Vomiting?
Saunders answered for him.
Aye. Something's got a hold of him. It's either the killing, the booze, or the food.
After a moment, Court shrugged.
It's not the killing.
Braz looked incredulously at Saunders.
You told us this man can really fight. He shows up tonight, disappears, and later the Syrians come in and tell us someone with special skills snatched a kid. You're certain you saw him after we got back from the police station? Because I sure as shit didn't. On me mother's grave, Saunders said.
The colonel addressed Court again.
If you were not arrested with the others, how did you get back to base?
Court didn't bat an eyelash.
Met a girl on the street in front of the bar who spoke English. I told her what happened. Figured she could help me get a taxi back, but she offered to drive me herself. Tried to pay her, but she wouldn't take it.
The girl, what's her name?
The colonel asked.
I didn't ask. I just needed a ride. Braz and Saunders both looked at Court now. They'd known that Waleed had been their driver, and he hadn't gotten himself arrested, so they figured Court would have returned to base with him. But even though his story was confusing to them, they weren't going to say anything about Waleed in front of the colonel that might get him in trouble. It wasn't that they were being kind, no. He was their ticket off base, and they'd do nothing to screw with that setup. The Desert Hawks colonel left the room with his men a moment later, satisfied he could report to his higher-ups that his highly trained contractors had nothing to do with any crimes in the city that evening, beyond cracking a few bottles over heads in a disco. Court wondered how long it would take for the Desert Hawks forces to find out Waleed wasn't anywhere to be found, and what danger that might bring to his operation. Braz and Van Wyck both asked about Waleed as soon as the militiamen were out of the room. Court just shrugged and said he went looking for him after the fight, but had no idea what happened to him. 30 minutes later, Court lay on his bunk, his eyes open, staring into the darkness above him. He had a million worries on his mind, but he wasn't able to process them all, because he knew this long night was not quite over yet. When Saunders appeared standing over his bunk, Court told himself he'd finally be able to deal with the last hanging thread of his interminably long first day in Syria. Court sat up without a word, stood, and followed Saunders out into the team room. They continued through the front door and walked through the dark for a full minute before arriving at a secluded area near an empty storage shed within sight of the main gate. Here, Saunders turned around and faced him.
"You might think about saying thank you."
"Thank you. Yeah? Well,
I knew since you got here you weren't who you said you were. I read Graham Wade's CV, and you, mate, ain't him. That shit on the road yesterday. You aren't some old, washed-up Canadian ex-infantry officer. You shoot, move, and communicate better than any other contractor I've ever worked with in my life."
"You're no slouch yourself. Look, what do you say tomorrow morning we tell each other how awesome we are? I really need to hit the rack." Saunders ignored him.
"I knew you were up to something. All that wandering about who we were fighting as if it fucking matters around here. I sussed out you had another objective in Syria beyond coming down and fighting for the Hawks to earn a paycheck. I knew, but I didn't know if whatever you were here for was good, bad, or indifferent."
"I'm a good guy," Court quipped.
"Right. Kidnapping kids. That'll learn you a sainthood for sure."
"I had nothing to do with..."
"Sell me another. I told myself after the contact with Jabhat al-Nusra that I was going to watch you close. So I did. At the disco, I saw you leave with the Tiger Forces bastard's phone, then walk right back in and deny it. I watched you trying to get the fight going in the bar. Couldn't figure out what your game was, but when we got back here and you still weren't around, I went looking for Waleed. He's not back either."
Saunders continued.
"He was too bloody pissed to help out with a kidnapping, so I figure you just needed his wheels and his uniform. Is that it?"
"You're the drunk one, Saunders."
"Not too drunk to notice that gash on the side of your head. You didn't have that in the bar."
"Yeah, I did."
"You aren't the only man here with a brain, Wade. I know you've been moonlighting tonight, so tell me. Who's a little shitbird you nicked, eh? He belonged to somebody important, a general, a Ba'ath Party official. Where do you have him stashed?"
"Why the hell would I come here to snatch somebody's baby?"
"Dunno. Money, I reckon. We were at the police station when the call came in. Once word got out about the kid, the cops couldn't get rid of us fast enough. They had a real crime to deal with. Whoever's kid was taken was so important, the whole city's police force was tripping over each other to look for him. Must be a nice payday for you."
Court did not reply.
"Come on, man. I can walk out of here and go tell the colonel that on second thought it wasn't you puking in the loo after all."
Court realized he might have to kill Saunders to keep him quiet. The man had done him a favor, but he was expendable if he tried to do anything to impede Court from assisting in providing intelligence on the Syrian president. But then Saunders said something that changed everything.
"Fine. Don't tell me, but here's how it's gonna be. I want a quarter of the take. Not just for getting the guns off you 30 minutes ago, but I'll help you out with your exfil. You managed to slip away tonight, but you can't do that whenever you want, especially considering the Desert Hawks are going to have their eyes on you now.
Court was hopeful about this turn of events, but he continued to feign ignorance about the kidnapping.
Again, we have to muster at 6 a.m. Can I just go back to the bunkhouse? And a look of realization flashed in Saunders's eyes.
Wait. You didn't have time to go far after you snatched that baby. Where do you have him stashed?
Court realized arguing with this guy was going to be futile. Saunders smiled.
I'm your problem solver. Where is the kid going?
Court sighed. He gave up the ruse. The West. The Brit's eyes went wild.
Fuck me, mate! You have to exfil him from the country? Are you bloody mad? That's a tall order.
I don't have to do it. I just had to get him out of where he was and deliver him somewhere else in the city. I did it.
Good. Is he somewhere safer now?
It's serious, Saunders. Nowhere is safe.
Sure enough.
But yeah, I think so. My job is done, but I won't get paid till he gets out.
Saunders started to reply, but Court cut him off.
And that means you don't get paid till he gets out. We'll go up north tomorrow, get out of here, do our jobs, and when we get back to Damascus, I should have the money in an account I can access.
No tricks, White.
This whole operation was nothing but a big bag of tricks, Court thought. But he simply nodded at the Englishman, then looked at his watch. If I'm lucky, I can get myself about 20 minutes sleep tonight before I have to get up and get my gear together.
Sweet dreams, then, Saunders said. But remember, I'm expecting a cut for what happened tonight.
You made that clear, Court said.
Saunders led the way back to the bunkhouse with a spring in his step, because he thought he was going to make some money. Court walked behind him, and it occurred to him that the three Confederates in his scheme now consisted of a Syrian doctor with no espionage or military experience, a Frenchman who had either double-crossed or turned his back on everyone he had worked with over the past week, and now a cutthroat mercenary who seemed tickled fucking pink at the chance to take part in a kidnapping of a baby so he could earn some quick cash. He told himself, and not for the first time on this operation, that the only one he could rely on was himself.
Chapter 55. There was no sleep for the gray man. After he lay in bed awake for just minutes, the lights came back on, the men began climbing out of their bunks, burping and farting and cussing, and within moments they were gearing up for the trip to the front lines to the northeast. As had been the norm since he got here, the team was a surly group, with little conversation between them, even after Brunetti and Anders returned from the hospital to join the others for the mission. To Court, it was as if these guys were already prepping themselves for the action ahead. Not the danger. That had a tendency to draw men together and increase comradeship. No, these guys, from the perspective of Court's trained eye, were getting their heads ready to kill people, whether or not the killing had anything to do with the war going on. Venwick took Court into a loadout room in the next building and told him to grab whatever he wanted from the well-stocked crates, racks, and shelves full of KWA gear. From the weapon racks, he pulled a pristine-looking Kalashnikov, with a short barrel and folding wire stock, and a desert sand-colored Glock 9mm pistol in a drop-leg holster. He chose a set of ceramic plate body armor in a plate carrier, which he then hung over his shoulder and cinched to his body by means of a Velcro cummerbund. He grabbed ammunition, a combat knife, a pair of fragmentation grenades, flashlights and batteries, emergency medical supplies, and all this went onto a load-bearing vest he donned over the plate carrier. He put on knee pads and elbow pads and selected a pair of tactical gloves, cutting off the trigger fingers on both hands with a tactical knife. He filled a backpack full of bottled water, vacuum-packed rations, and a camouflage jacket. Lastly, he found a Kevlar helmet that fit him, retrieved a pair of ballistic-rated sunglasses from a case, and headed outside. Completely geared up, he looked like all the other KWA men, which meant he didn't look too much different from the Desert Hawks Brigade soldiers themselves, except for the white hawk badge on the left shoulder of their uniforms versus the unadorned shoulders of the KWA men. At 6 a.m. on the dot, Court stood in front of the barracks as a long procession of trucks, infantry fighting vehicles, armored personnel carriers, T-72 tanks, and utility vehicles passed by on the way to the front gate.
Van Wyck addressed the group with a short briefing, basically telling the men they were there to assist with pacifying a couple of villages in an hour to the east of Palmyra, and they'd learn more details during the 4 to 6 hour transport to the area. He pointed to the new man, the one he knew as Wade, and gave him the call sign, Kylo 9. For years, while working in SAD's ground branch,